Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Philip Beverly, Charles Lipson, and Chris Roebling. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. We archive this program, and so you can, if you miss it in a week, you can go back and actually, you can probably go back several years and listen and watch some of our broadcasts if you are watching in Chicago. We're a television show in Chicago in addition to being a national radio program. Well, tonight is a historic night. It is obviously the anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday, but the big news is, of course, Barack Obama was re-inaugurated today in a private ceremony in the White House, and it will become, so it is official. He and Joe Biden are back in the saddle again for the next 4 years, and tomorrow at noon, again, there will be the public ceremony on the steps of the United States Capitol. And so tonight, we are going to sort of broaden our base, and we're going to look at the first 4 years of Barack Obama and then look ahead to the next 4 years as he begins to build a legacy. And I would be interested in hearing from all sides, those people who think that Barack Obama has been a terrific president. We certainly want to hear from you. And I know there's a large number of people that listen to this broadcast that don't think he's been a great president. We'll hear from you as well. And put it in context, we'll try to keep the level of animus to some degree as we look and have our discussion this evening on a historic day, because regardless of whether you are a Republican or a Democrat or what your political stripe might be, there is something magic. There should be something magic in there. We've had a peaceful continuation or transformation of government in the United States. Philip Beverly, let me turn to you. You are a professor at Chicago State University. You are an African-American, for those people listening to this program on radio, and also because you have been a regular guest on this program for a long, long time. People will recall that during the primary 4 years ago, you were not, he was not your choice for,
was not.
For
no.
Bill Richardson was.
Yes.
So my question to you is, as now that you've had 4 years as to assess President Barack Obama, how would you assess his first 4 years, and has he turned out to be a better president than you once thought he would be?
Bruce, I think it's actually mixed for me. I think on the domestic side, didn't quite meet expectations. I'm glad about the Affordable Care Act and that, but there were some other things that I think he could have done better. On the foreign policy side, I think he's been outstanding. 6 months in the saddle and the Somali pirate kidnapping resolution, and then 3 years in, you know, the takedown of Osama bin Laden, the pretty systematic dismantling as we can of Al-Qaeda, getting us out of Iraq, trying to get us out of Afghanistan. So I think that the record's sort of mixed.
Chris Roebling is our card-carrying Republican tonight. Chris, again, longtime listeners to this program will know that Chris has been a vociferous critic of Barack Obama. And 4 years ago, when the world was trying to learn a little bit more about him, you painted a very bleak picture of what leadership style he would bring to the White House. Mm-hmm. Is there anything about that first 4 years that you could say, again, putting your Republican partisanship aside, and say, yeah, he did a pretty good job. I'll tip my hat to him for X.
Well, I supported him on the surge in Afghanistan. I'm sorry, and I thought that was a good idea, which he sort of crippled almost on the day he announced it by saying that we would be out by a date certain. I think that this is I think that his first term is reflected very well by a nonpartisan, maybe a little bit of a liberal columnist for the Washington Post, Dana Milbank. I think he's a little more liberal than whatever else he might be. And Dana Milbank just said today, quote, the Messiah never came. And when you think about the first term, you think about the hope for transformational change and changing the tone of Washington, I think it's important to remember that his first act was to close Guantanamo. And now here we are 4 years later, Guantanamo remains open.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's been a growing and a maturing, and that's indicated by a lot of changes in his positions that he took when he was a senator or when he was a candidate against Senator McCain. But I don't think we have a lot to point to, and we're, except for the growth of the debt of the United States.
Charles Lipson is our third guest this evening. He is a veteran professor of political science at the University of Chicago. And the University of Chicago was once represented in the Illinois State Senate by Barack Obama. And many of your colleagues at the U of C thought that he was the Messiah 4 years ago. You're not as far left as many of your colleagues down there, so you sort of stand out to be a voice of moderation, if not conservative in some areas. What assessment and what grade would you give him on the expectation level, first of all, Charles?
Well, in our precinct, just so you'll get a sense of the politics, I think there were between 3% and 4% of the vote was for the Republican. Right. So
diverse.
And
you're embracing diversity down there.
Yeah. So that's the basic position at the university. The nobody could satisfy the expectations that people had of him. He is a very gifted campaigner. And I think one of the things that we learned during the first term was that he continued to campaign. And I think you have to do that. One of the things we learned this week, Bruce, was that they were basically keeping the campaign in place, and they were going to campaign for his agenda. I think that whatever part of the agenda he will get through, he'll get through in the first 18 months or so right now, and then after that it gets stopped up by the next campaign. But he's been a gifted campaigner. I think the other thing that we've really learned about him is that he really has governed essentially from the left. He really hasn't put together bipartisan coalitions. His big achievements were put through almost on party line votes.
Do you believe, Philip Beverly, that the Republicans at any point we're going to give him the benefit of the doubt, the opportunity to live up to some of the things that either he said in his campaign or his supporters read into what he was saying in the campaign?
No. When the minority leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, made it his job to make sure that Barack Obama was not elected to a second term, that said to me there was no possibility of bipartisanship on anything.
Doesn't every political leader say that about the opposition? It just so happened that maybe Mitch McConnell was a little more candid than others.
I don't recall Harry Reid doing that in 2004. So I don't recall that.
We're going to pause. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. We're assessing President Barack Obama's first 4 years in the White House. We want to get your assessment. We'll also be looking ahead to the next 4 years and also talking about the political hot potato that is before Congress and the nation at the moment, and that is gun control. We'll talk about that at length before we go off the air this evening. 1-800-723-8029. I'm Bruce Dumont from Chicago. From Tuscaloosa, Alabama to Tulsa, Oklahoma, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. 1-800-723-8029 is the telephone number. Let's go to Hector listening to us tonight on our flagship station, WLS Radio, calling from St. Charles. Go ahead. You're on the air, Hector.
You know, this is Barack Obama all during the campaign, and he kept talking about jobs in the economy and making things better, but I think he's using this gun control thing as a distraction from the economy. The economy's been bad for so long now. There's a lot of people hurting, and a lot of people have just been holding on and holding on, and we can't hold on anymore.
All right,
the economy is so bad.
Stand by. I want to get everybody an opportunity to sort of respond to that. Obviously, sometimes events, world events, domestic events, they do alter the legislative agenda. But do you agree that maybe the president is, again, you know, seizing a moment because he thinks he has some momentum on his side? But again, it isn't necessarily what a lot of people voted for him to do.
Oh, I think gun control is red meat for the liberal left. It is something that gets his base excited. It has nothing to do with growing the economy or positioning the economy to grow significantly in the 21st century. Our replacement rate for jobs is about 155,000 per month. And over the last 6 months, our average job creation has been about 155,000. So we are not improving on the 7.8% unemployment. And if there was anybody else in the White House except for this particular liberal Democrat, I think that you would hear the left howling in disapproval for what it's doing to the middle class. And when you get into the subsets, you know, African-American youth have got the worst unemployment level in two generations.
Philip, in your view, has the president squandered opportunities to deal with more economic issues because it may not be his most comfortable area?
I don't know that he's had much much space to maneuver there. I mean, so he sends. We go through the ritual every March where he sends up the joke that is the budget that he proposes, and it never gets voted on in the House or the Senate. And we go through these continuing resolutions.
Why not?
And we're not serious about it.
Why does that happen? Why is his budget not taken seriously by the majority of Democrats in the United States Senate?
Let's say 97 to nothing.
It's repudiated. It is repudiated by the Democrats.
Why?
I don't think it's the president's responsibility, quite frankly. So he submits the budget. The people who need to spend the money
is
the Congress.
To lead?
According to the Budget Act, it is his responsibility.
But I think even members of both parties have said we're kicking the can down the road on a number of issues. And I think this is one of those things. We're kicking the can down the road.
Charles?
Let me address the caller. The caller asked about gun control. I think that the gun control was not an issue. Either side really campaigned on it. Came up because of this terrible slaughter, which came on top of many other previous high-profile events. So I think that they had to do something. And while it is red meat for the left, it's also red meat for the right. And I doubt much will go through. I think that what will go through are the presidential directives. I think that his problem on the economy, which is the second issue, the main issue that the caller spoke about, I think we have a sense of what the president wants to do. The problem is a sort of large government Keynesian stimulus type program plus a fair amount of money showered on specially favored industries has run into two basic problems. One is that it has not boosted the economy. We're just not getting enough jobs. That was Chris's point. And the other is that we've run into a fiscal cliff.
In looking at the constituents that the constituency group that really propelled him to office, and they really were swept up by the political revolution of 4 years ago. I would like to get response from everybody here, and also those who are listening from coast to coast. I want to certainly hear from you. He inspired the young. Are the young really inspired? Are the young better off today than they were 4 years ago? Hispanics. I would say that Hispanics probably are better off than they were 4 years ago. I would say that gays and lesbians are a lot better off than they were several years ago. But the hardcore anti-war left, can they be happy? Can they be happy that Guantanamo is still open? I mean, can they be happy with a foreign policy that has almost tripled the number of drone strikes?
Well, I think that that's part of this maturation process. He said he would close Guantanamo. He learned that he cannot close Guantanamo. He said that he opposed drone strikes. Now he is, according to the New York Times and according to a leak investigation that's not being pursued very vigorously, he is personally deciding who will be exploded by our drone strikes. So I think that the left has to look at his foreign policy, and I take a very different view over my friend Philip, but I think if you go down Russia, the reset has brought nothing. I think China is now showing very significant regional ambitions and maybe beyond their regional ambitions. North Korea is still a basket basket case, Iran. If you look at our friends in the Middle East, our friends are gone or our friends are imperiled, and you look at our enemies and they're strengthened. I mean, you look at Egypt was a friendly nation. You look at how we
were. Was his handling of Egypt a mistake?
I think that his handling of Egypt showed that they were unprepared for the kind of democratic transition that everyone in the American foreign policy establishment knew was coming at some point. And it was just as unprepared as his response to the Iranian democratic protesters when they were crawling out for some kind of democratic reform in Iran. He was no place to be found.
There's a tremendous concern among American voters about a lighter footprint abroad. They wanted to see, after all these wars, they mm-hmm. wanted to see America withdraw. And the fact that America withdrew and bin Laden was dead are his cachet moments. But all the basic problems that Chris just talked about, the biggest being, I would say, Iran and North Korea, plus the rise of al-Qaeda in North Africa, are really still out there. And it's not just that they haven't been solved. It's really quite unclear what the administration's approach to them is.
Philip?
I think the real challenges that he has is managing the smaller footprint with less resources, because we simply don't have the money to go do the things that we may want to do in those areas. And trying to use some other strategies to deal with Iran short of some military action, which unfortunately may be required.
Back to a domestic issue. Is life better today for African Americans than it was 4 years ago? The hope for change, the hope for improved conditions, the hope for improved education, jobs. Is it better today after 4 years of having an African American president?
No, I don't think so. I think I don't believe that it's worse. I think it's sort of unchanged, and there's still the waiting. And so are there issues that affect primarily African Americans that this president is going to address? And he took some criticism in the first administration, the first 4 years, about that. Is he going to now say something different about issues that are primarily African American issues? And we don't know that.
Dude, I would be surprised, because, as I said, clearly his executive order on the DREAM Act made things significantly better for a lot of Latinos. His actions for gays and lesbians, whether it's gays in the military, significantly better for them. But in the second administration, what I'm hearing you say is that Barack Obama is going to have an opportunity to be a little blacker than he was in the first 4 years?
He'll have an opportunity. I don't imagine that he would take that opportunity.
Why not? Is he worried about his place in history?
I think he walks a very fine line of being able to talk about some things. For example, reparations always comes up in classes that I teach. How come we never have the conversation? We haven't ever really had the large meta conversation about race in this country. We just haven't. We've had sort of minor conversations, and I think there's still a lot of angst in this country around that issue. Bill Clinton had the opportunity to begin that conversation, and he could. Barack Obama isn't the man to have to initiate that, because it's coming from the place of the people on the other side of it who were the oppressed.
Doesn't that mean that issue is never going to be addressed, in your view, Charles? Do you agree with what Philip just said?
I think it's important that President Obama has not governed as a black president or as a biracial president. He represents those things, and that's actually wonderful. And I think it's a wonderful thing that Americans can see a president who is black or biracial. But I think that Philip is right in saying that it's a very dangerous thing if he paints himself as particularistic. He's the president of all the people. You can see the criticism he gets when he's seen as too partisan, which is often the case as well, because he has this rhetoric. The rhetoric that was most appealing in the first campaign was bring us all together rhetoric. He was not able to do that in the second campaign, not because he didn't want to, but because nobody would believe it, given that he had governed either from his own choice or because of the Republicans. There's a debate, but he had governed in a very partisan way.
But he still has tremendous political or popular support. Over 74% of the American people like him personally, so
right.
He's got a lot of political capital in that respect. 1-800-723-8029. We've got callers on the line. We'll hear from Texas when we come back from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us this evening, around the table this evening. Philip Beverly is here. Philip Beverly is an associate professor of political science for many years at Chicago State University. Also joining us this evening is Chris Roebling. Once upon a time, he was the executive director of the Cook County Republican Party. He is also with Jane Thompson and Associates, and also he does political analysis for WGN Television in the morning. And also joining us is Charles Lipson, the voice of Marks, Mississippi, for 37 years, a professor of political science at the University of Chicago, and also someone who became somewhat controversial earlier last year, mm-hmm. when there was talk that the Obama Presidential Library could mm-hmm. be coming to Chicago, and you sort of suggested that maybe it wasn't something that would work very well at the University of Chicago. I'm
that's
sure
right.
that went over like a pregnant pole vaulter.
Oh, well.
When was the last time you heard that?
Really,
when was the last time you heard that?
I think it was
a
lead balloon. Do you remember that one? Well, my view is that it's perfectly appropriate for the city of Chicago to have a presidential museum, and it's perfectly appropriate for the University of Chicago to honor the president. Normally you do that by naming a building, professorships, mm-hmm. scholarships, something like that. The real reason that I have concerns about the university affiliating with an Obama museum is that there's the keeping of presidential papers. That's done by the government. That's fine. Every university should have that. But the rest of it is really two things. One of it is a celebratory museum, and the other is essentially a think tank as a place where the president, former president, and all of his or her aides can sit forever and advance their political agenda. That's a fine thing to do, but it ought to be independent, like the Reagan Library, not connected to a university like the George W. Bush Library or the John F. Kennedy Library. That's just my opinion.
Okay. Before we continue and go back to calls, I do want to make one programming note. If you're listening within the city of Chicago, there are many who would argue that there would never have been a Barack Obama had there not been, 30 years ago, a Mayor Harold Washington in the city of Chicago. Barack Obama, in his own autobiography about why he came to Chicago, it was because of the political revolution that Harold Washington, Chicago's first black mayor, was able to light 30 years ago. In fact, it was 30 years ago this month that Harold Washington participated in the first of the mayoral debates, which really catapulted him from a relatively obscure congressman known only in the black community to a much broader constituency. And this year, since Harold Washington's broadcast legacy, both radio and television, does exist, and it exists here at the Museum of Broadcast Communications, next Friday, starting on the 25th of January, we are going to present a special exhibition. It's called Harold Washington on the Air, a 30th anniversary retrospective. It's going to run from January 25th through February 28th. The museum is open Tuesday through Saturday, And we're going to be screening the memorable television appearances and radio appearances of Harold Washington from 10 in the morning till 5 p.m. Admission for that period of time will be totally free. Free admission at the Museum of Broadcast Communications, 360 North State Street. And again, next week I'll tell you about a special seminar that we're going to be having. If you want to circle the date of Wednesday, February 6th, I'll tell you more about it next week. But again, if you're within the sound of my voice in Chicago and you agree that it was a significant moment in the history of this city with a very charismatic leader. And I know there's a lot of people that listen to this program, and I know we do have young people that listen to this program. We have a lot of people who are new to Chicago. And if you really want to understand what transpired 30 years ago in this city, there really was a political revolution, and it was led by an extremely charismatic political leader by the name of Harold Washington. If you want to see it for yourself, hear him on the radio, see him on television, and I think you'll grasp the magnitude of the man.
Bruce, I'm so excited that you're doing that, because I don't think people around the country or the world, I don't think Barack Obama can be accurately understood except in reference to Harold Washington. Just mm-hmm. for one example, when he was a student at Columbia in 1983, in the spring of 1983, he registered for and attended a socialist scholars conference at Cooper's Union. This is all established fact. This is not some, you know, crackpot idea. That conference was overtaken with a sense of excitement and hope for its future because Harold Washington, 60 days prior, had won the mayoralty in Chicago. And
which was an international story, given the racial animus that participated in some
divisive in the city.
It was a huge story, and Harold Washington's coalition from the Democratic primary, then winning the general election against a Republican who came out of nowhere, sort of thing, and then getting reelected in 1987. That Harold Washington coalition, I believe, is the outline of the winning tickets for Barack Obama, both in mm-hmm. 2008 and in 2012.
I agree.
Let me add one thing to that. One of the really smart things that Harold Washington did before he was elected is he said, everybody understood he was the best candidate for that progressive rainbow coalition idea. He said, I'll only do it. And I forget the number.
It was 100,000.
100,000 more people get registered.
New registrants, yeah.
And so even before he ran, he had activated people out there. Now, I want people to think about what happened this summer with over the past year, really, with David Axelrod and the program that got out the vote of people who might not have been registered, got them registered, got them out. So there were a lot of continuities here, not only the coalition that was put together, well-to-do liberals, funding from that section, people who were kind of traditional do-good government types, plus a lot of community activists, a lot of African-Americans, Hispanic votes, all of that. The same kind of coalition, and many of the same people who got their first start in that. But I want to ask you a question, Bruce. Mm-hmm. How often was he on with you? How often did you interview him? And in particular, what do you remember?
Well, he was I don't want to say he was a regular guest on the predecessor show called Inside Politics, but he was on probably 10 times. He was the very first guest on a program called Chicago Tonight, which Chicago people know about on mm-hmm. WTTW. So we knew each other well. I had the opportunity to be the negotiator and the producer of the mayoral debates which he thought really were the defining moment. That, I mean, clearly when he had that first debate, I mean, he knocked it out of the park. I mean, he clearly was the smartest guy in the room, and I've argued and said this when we do tours here at the museum. I mean, he was able to do in that first mayoral debate what John Kennedy was able to do in the very first debate that he had with Richard Nixon.
Right.
He was the smartest guy, on the stage that night. And I think what also happened is there were many African Americans who didn't necessarily believe that he really had a shot. And the credibility that he gained and the expansion of his base within the African-American community was one of the things that grew tremendously from that very first debate. There ended up being four primary debates, and there was a debate against Bernard Epstein.
So it was a case where the media really made a difference.
There's absolutely no question. You mentioned David Axelrod. David Axelrod, one of the key political advisors to the President of the United States. He was a reporter for the Chicago Tribune. 30 years ago. He covered Harold Washington. He eventually, when he moved from being a reporter inside the political tent, he was a media advisor for Harold Washington's reelection campaign in 1987.
Right.
And then when Richard M. Daley came along, he became an advisor to him. So it really goes back, this campaign or this 30th anniversary, it talks about the transition from David Axelrod as a reporter to a political operative. And Philip, I want to give you an opportunity to sort of offer your two cents into the linkage between, and you agree that there would not have been a President Barack Obama without a Harold Washington.
Absolutely. The idea of the coalition building. But I think more fundamentally, at least with African Americans, the thing that emerged from the Harold Washington campaign was the possibility. It's possible to have this, given the nature of race politics in the city of Chicago over decades, that there's now the possibility of something different. And then some years later, Barack Obama being that sort of next level, you mean it's possible that an African American could be president?
There's one fundamental difference.
Yeah, I want to
that is that Washington was much more identified with the black community in Chicago. That was also because the white community here really opposed him. There was deep racial division. And I wonder how much President Obama's attempt to not be defined racially, a comment you made in your last intervention, was related to what he saw as problems in the Washington administration.
I want to give you a chance to respond to that, but we are about to go to a break. 1-800-723-8029. We do have callers. We are going to hear from them in Austin, Texas. And again, we invite you to come and participate in the museum if you live in the Chicagoland area again. Starting this Friday, January 25th, through the entire month of February, Tuesday through Saturday, free of charge, 10 in the morning till 5 at night. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us. Let's go back to calls. We got people standing by in Texas. Alan, listening to us on KLBJ in Austin. Go ahead. You're on the air, Alan. Thanks for being patient.
Yeah, and thanks for putting on your program, Bruce. You know, a lot of thorny subjects and controversial subjects are brought up each week.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. I hope that it shows that I have as much fun doing this program as I do anything. It's the most fun 2 hours I have all week.
Okay, let me get my comments have to do with the kind of a Chicago myopic viewpoint that in a way, your program exemplifies, because most of your guests and you yourself are, you know, proudly Chicago.
Right.
And when it comes to issues like race, I mean, it's automatically assumed it's a white versus black thing. Well, you know, I supported Herman Cain. I'm a white guy. I supported Herman Cain because he was a conservative. Now, what? I think a lot of times, I mean, it was the same thing when Hillary Clinton first came on the political scene. The mainstream media, and probably the Chicago media, said, oh, they're opposed to Hillary because she's a strong woman. No, she was a liberal. We're not opposed to strong women. We're opposed to liberals. And likewise, Harold Washington was probably perceived by a lot of white people in Chicago as a big government liberal who was going to increase taxes. Now,
that's true.
When it comes to the, can I address the gun control issue?
Absolutely.
There again, it's a typical myopic Chicago perspective. I mean, you've got, in the city of Chicago, you've got about 10% of the city where most of the murders are taking place, and it's probably drug culture related. Why don't the police get in there and clean out that? After 40 years, why do they let it fester? Why do they let the cancer continue in the body of Chicago? It's like the police don't want to go there, and the drug community doesn't want the police to attend, to intervene.
Alan, I don't want you to go off the line. I want you to stay on the line, but I do want Philip Beverly and the rest of us to respond to it. But I do want to talk about because, again, we've talked about, in fact, again, if we're a little overly Chicago proud for you, I mean, I don't know how many times I've talked about, you know, the crime rate, the murder rate. Over 504 people were murdered in Chicago. I talk about that all the time. And my question to you, now, would you agree, Philip, with the caller, that most of these murders do happen on the south and west sides, and most of that is black-on-black crime?
They do, and I'm always shocked by that term, black-on-black crime, as if the people that are around you that you're committing crimes against, it doesn't differ in the white community. It would be ridiculous to say, oh, well, white-on-white crime. I think John Wayne Gacy, for example, didn't kill any African-Americans. But we would never say that that's white-on-white crime. Mm-hmm. It's drug-related, economically-based crime. When the economic opportunities are as limited as they are in certain communities, Inglewood always is going to come to mind, people are going to do what they need to do to survive. When Intel and Microsoft and have a problem of conflict resolution, they go to court. They get an army of lawyers, and they resolve their conflict that way. When two drug dealers have a conflict, they resolve it a different way.
I hate to simplify it
that way. That's the way it is.
But beyond the common denominator of drugs in many of these cases, or turf in many of these cases, the greater common denominator is it's a breakdown in the family structure. In most cases, there is not a father present. Level of fear, and it is there has been a tolerance of neighborhoods crumbling due to crime. And again, you know, every time there's one of these horrendous murders in Chicago, I mean, there's going to be some local minister who's out there campaigning. It may be Father Flager, and I think he certainly means well. He wants to bring the bully pulpit of his ability to bring media attention. But what is the answer? Why is it getting worse, in your view, Chris Roebling?
Well, I think the particular increase, the most recent increase in Chicago crime in the African-American areas to which you refer, as related to drugs, is a consequence of a very successful series of prosecutions at the top levels of the two big affiliations of gangs in Chicago. So the top leadership has been cleared out, and a lot of people at the mid or lower level are now fighting with each other to see who's going to move up to become top
only the
leadership.
Number of gangs, based on Teal Hardeman, who was here from Ceasefire last week, he said there's now about 600 gangs.
Yeah, so
the
there's
big
been
two
a,
no longer exist.
Well, the big
in any
two
structural way.
That's
Al-Qaeda. Part of the problem.
They're more of an idea.
The folk nation, the people nation, the big two don't exist as they used to.
Right.
And you've got warring factions. That's what's going on. But I think what we have to look at as a society is that we have spent $16 trillion on President Johnson's war on poverty. And in certain neighborhoods, whether you're in Los Angeles or New York City or Dallas, Texas or Chicago, things are not appreciably better. And we have seen a decline in the African-American family structure. And we've got decline in our schools in these neighborhoods. We've got to address this because we are not going to. This is a Republican saying we're all in this together. And we're not going to flourish as a nation in the 21st century if we cannot involve all of these people productively in our economy and our society.
Alan, in your point, by the way, your point about the societal issues, there's no question that if we can't deal with the societal issues, all the gun laws in the world are not going to have any great impact. They're certainly not going to, and this is what we discussed last week, they're certainly, whatever the plan, the president's plan is, it's not going to have a significant impact in the inner city crime that we're talking about. There's two different crime waves that we may be dealing about. Listen, on that note, we are out of time in hour number one. Charles Lipson, I'm going to give you more chance to talk in the next hour. Philip Beverly, thank you very much for being with us. They'll be back in the next hour, as well as our Republican, Chris Roebling. He'll be back as well. 1-800-723-8029. We do have telephone callers on the line. We're going to continue this discussion in the next hour if you're listening to us on radio. If you're watching this program in Chicago, we'll see you next week. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont. We continue with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway, tonight featuring commentary by Philip Beverly of Chicago State University, Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago, and political activist and public affairs executive and commentator on WGN-TV, Chris Roebling. They're all here. Phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. We're talking on this historic night, President Barack Obama having been re-inaugurated officially today. The big ceremony, of course, will take place tomorrow. But according to the Constitution, it is January 20th at noon when it all took place in a private meeting at the or ceremony with Justice Roberts. He got the oath right this time. As you remember, 4 years ago, he kind of blew his first big opportunity on the big stage. But
Oops.
That is what we're talking about. Looking at the first 4 years, the next 4 years of Barack Obama, and again, obviously the circumstances of Sandy Hook, Connecticut, or Newtown, Connecticut, and the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School has really dominated the news of the past month. And the president, based on some research and some work that the vice president has been doing, he came out with his series and measures designed to prevent gun violence. It's been described as the most sweeping gun control package in two decades. Proposals could face a rough ride in Congress. And I think I'd like to spend a little time just talking about that, not necessarily the rest of the show. As you all know, the package includes universal background checks on all gun buyers, a renewed ban on military-style assault weapons, and also restricting ammunition magazines to no more than 10 rounds.
Useless.
Now, the commentary is coming from our Republican.
I mean, it's just, you know, a magazine, these things. I don't own a gun. I've shot guns sort of at Boy Scout camp and once a few years ago with some friends of mine. That's the only two times, really. And I want to say, number two, these magazines are metal boxes with springs. So it's utterly meaningless. And when they talk about military style, there is no military that would use a semi-automatic. You want to talk about semi-automatic weapons. Teddy Roosevelt used semi-automatic weapons on his hunting trips in 1895. I mean, this is the worst and most shameless kind of exploitative political posturing that has nothing to do with the underlying issues, and it really is intended to advance an agenda of repealing the Second Amendment without having to stand up and say, I have an amendment to repeal the Second Amendment.
Okay, now let me just finish my point. You are correct. That's the gun piece of this. And as you know, when we did the program immediately after Sandy Hook, I said that it was not just guns. Guns was part of it, but mental health and our pop culture were part of it as well. And again, this new package includes new school safety and mental health programs, all designed to prevent shootings. Now, the NRA, which initially proposed that they have armed guards in schools. They have vowed to fight the gun control aspects, the gun-related stuff, although they have proposed armed guards in schools and expanding databases to block gun purchases by people who have been declared mentally ill. Now, again, what seems to be the case is that you have a number of people that have weighed in on that. One being the woman by the name of Doris Fuller. She is executive director of the Treatment Advocacy Center in Virginia, and she said it's a terrible thing that takes terrible acts for everyone, from the public to the president, to look comprehensively, there's that word again, at this situation. But we think, but we can't think in silos, just as looking at gun control. We have to deal with mental illness. And so part of this plan is there is a mental health component. The administration is proposing a Project AWARE, which stands for Advancing Wellness and Resilience in Education. It would be designed to reach about 750,000 people to identify mental illness early in young people and refer them for treatment. Also, Congress has been asked to fund research into the impact of video games on young minds. That's something else we've also talked about, as to whether or not the president can use his popularity in Hollywood, and since many in Hollywood and the gaming industry were supportive of him, can he use some of his political capital to get them to act in a more responsible way? And then the plan also proposes money to help local school districts hire 1,000 school resource officers and school counselors. And
in what state?
Throughout the country.
I mean,
throughout the country.
Seriously.
Throughout the country.
If we're going to talk about this comprehensively, I'm a bit ambivalent on the assault weapons ban. I don't think anybody can disagree with universal background checks. And if they do, they definitely don't need to have a gun. Do the universal background checks. Saying that they haven't worked, if you check the statistics, 2 million people who were not able to purchase guns because they couldn't pass that background right. check since it came up in the 90s.
Times.
It worked at least 2 million times. So we know that that'll work. The bigger problem, I think, is at that cultural level that you mentioned last, which is how do we address a culture of violence? And I think it's so few people who act out in this way, mentally ill or not. I get that. The other thing I'm concerned about with mental illness is who's going to pay for this? I hear more stories from parents of mentally ill teenagers or young adults that the resources aren't available to them. So if we're going to be serious about it, we're going to have to say that at least that portion of healthcare has got to be accessible to people.
I could not agree with you more. But in this case, which seems to me that, you know, when you're trying to bring sides together, it seems to me that you want to find the areas where there can be some common ground. And you find a little bit here, and maybe one side has got to give, and then the other side's got to give. And so finally, you get to something that is meaningful. It seems to me that having armed guards in school should be a no-brainer. Not teachers. I don't want teachers to have it. Now, this was an idea that was suggested by the NRA. I'm not a member of the NRA. I don't think it's necessarily a bad idea just because it came from them. But the opposition, here is the opposition came from leadership of African-American organizations. The National Urban League president wrote, this was Mark Morial from New Orleans, "Of particular concern to us is their guards' interaction with children of color whose discipline issues are often dealt with as criminal matters, effectively fast-tracking them into the criminal justice system." So he doesn't like that idea. And then the head of the legal practice group of the NAACP says, "Bringing police into schools often negatively impacts the very children we are trying to protect. Police in schools often cross the line between safety and discipline, using overzealous methods to address normal adolescent behavior. African American students are significantly more likely than their peers to be arrested at school just for acting like teenagers." So you have two civil rights groups that oppose the idea of having armed guards in schools, all schools, not just black schools, where it seems to me that having an armed guard in the school could make that school a little bit safer. I want to get everybody's reaction, Philip, you and everyone listening, whether you agree or disagree with what I just said. 1-800-723-8029. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8029. We have certainly touched a nerve with my comments before the break. We got people from all over the country wanting to call in and offer my comments. Let's go to Stan, listening to us in Champaign, Illinois on WLS. Stan, go ahead.
Thanks very much, Bruce. I appreciate you taking my call. This armed guards in school thing is a waste of money. If you put an armed guard in a school, what you're doing is you're taking away two teachers. We've had armed guards in schools that failed to save any lives, and the case in point is Columbine.
Mm-hmm.
This whole armed guards in school is just more guns. It's
right.
More NRA silliness.
Do we all recognize that it was started by Bill Clinton, that Clinton in the 90s was very strongly behind an armed guard in every school? Do we all recognize that, Stan?
No, I didn't know that.
I didn't know that
I
either.
I didn't know that
I'd
either.
Never
oh,
heard
yeah.
that.
Clinton had that. It was a Clinton-era proposal that we would put guards in schools. This was not something that just came out.
Here's my point.
So now you're telling me that Bill Clinton was the genius that we should have all followed down
no,
the
I'm
road.
Not, no, I'm
no,
not
but
saying
here's my
that
point,
at all.
Stan, from a political standpoint, and then I want to engage you in conversation because we have a little disagreement on here. Okay, here's an issue now, where Chris has just said it was Bill Clinton's idea. It's an idea mm-hmm. that the NRA likes. It's an idea that a moderately conservative talk show like myself likes. And you make the point that it didn't work in Columbine. There will always be an exception.
But he also makes one other point, Bruce. He's saying these things aren't free. And would it be better in school after school after school if we had a couple more teachers, or at least one more, or had one of these guards? I think that's also a reasonable question.
Well, everything is going to cost money. But again, it seems to me that, and I don't certainly advocate that two teachers get fired because of this. It seems to me that it's one of the things that could give some level of comfort.
Right.
It would be hopefully a quicker response. I suggested last week program that it could also be returning of veterans coming back who have some experience. Go ahead.
Let me make one comment about level of comfort.
Yep.
We've been taking off our shoes in airports for 12 years, and we have found not one person trying to do a shoe bomb other than what's-his-face 12 years ago.
Right.
I mean, this is silliness. Level of comfort and things that actually work are two entirely different things. Armed guards in schools will not work because they didn't work when we had them at Columbine.
No, but that is one example. It's like saying, let me just make my point, Stan. It's like saying we shouldn't lock down schools. It's a waste of time to lock down schools. You know why? Because Sandy Hook was locked down. Sandy Hook was locked down. So, I mean, there are...
Local police response time at Sandy Hook was almost 20 minutes. Do you know local police response time at Sandy Hook was almost 20 minutes?
But in Aurora,
it was 90 seconds.
So right. I think there's another issue. Let me make one political point and then one more practical point. The political point is that Harry Reid is not going to allow any of this stuff to be voted on in the Senate.
Right.
Why is that? Because it is so toxic to moderate Democrats, and he does not want them to have to vote on these issues. So they're going to make the
– He has senators up from Alaska and from, I think,
six.
South Dakota,
he's got
maybe Colorado, places
So what
where,
that tells you, it's
right.
dead. In other
it's
words,
all
if
dead.
The Democrats
yeah.
if the Democrats won't allow their own vote – on it in the Senate. That just tells you that there's no possibility. The other thing is, if you guard the schools, they'll come after buses as the kids get off of a school bus. Well, there's 30 of them or 40 of them. Greg, so there are a lot of soft targets.
Greg in Fort Wayne, Indiana, listening to us on WoWo. Go ahead. Nice to hear from Indiana tonight.
Same here. Good evening to you all. I live in Tennessee. My wife's a middle school teacher.
Okay.
And in Tennessee, we have SRO officers in middle school and high school. And they seem to work fine. The gentleman just called, and you were correct to say, well, how many hundreds of school shootings didn't happen because they had SROs, and then you have Columbine? I'd like to point out that the police department there did a miserable job trying to solve that problem while the shooting was going on as well.
Mm-hmm.
40% of the people my wife teaches with are former military, mostly U.S. Army. We live in an Army town.
Right.
Where Fort Campbell is. And there's people right there that know how to use weapons and firearms. So I disagree with you, Bruce, about your thing about arming teachers. But I heard a point, and it might have been on your show last week, Bruce, or the week before.
So you think teachers should be armed?
If they are willing to undergo the proper training, yes.
Okay. Let me
point out, in Israel...
Ahead. I'd rather have them teach. Go ahead.
Well, in Israel, which is a draconian case, obviously, teachers actually carry real assault rifles to school, and ones that fire automatic weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's a draconian case. But the art of keeping somebody from opening fire on a school or a movie theater or whatever, any mass place, is the art of deterrence. And that's the mental thing where you don't know if somebody else is packing heat.
That's right.
Now, the guy
that
shut up the movie theaters, how many theaters did he go to be found before he went to the one that said, we don't allow guns here, and that's
right.
The one he went after.
Yep.
You make one point that's really worth following up on. You make several, but one that I want to follow up on. It sounds like there really needs to be more training for local police on responding to an emergency situation, that in some towns they really know how to do it. In Aurora, Colorado, they did. There was still a mass shooting. But in Columbine, they didn't. At least that's what you're reminding us of. And it sounds like that's the sort of thing that could be done fairly simply. And you could just ask police departments to have regular training on responding to emergency situations like this.
And they have done, actually, in part of my study. I'm an emergency manager and teach emergency management, and police departments across the country, as a result of Columbine, have shifted their tactical response from waiting for SWAT to get there to deal with the situation to getting, as soon as you got an officer or two there, they're directed to engage to stop the shooter immediately.
No
and,
kidding.
And it's ironic that in 75% of these mass shootings, the shooter's taken his own life. And it hasn't
and
been somebody else with a gun.
Have we had any results since this change, Philip? I mean, in other words, has it worked better, or are we just getting more first responders shot?
No, I don't think we've had any first responders shot in any of these mass shootings. I mean, it happened so quickly.
Do you think the idea of an armed guard is a good idea?
I think it's a much more complex idea in the world that I operate in intellectually in emergency management. You would do a risk analysis. You do a threat assessment to say, is this the place that we need to have an armed guard, and not try to have an overarching solution to the problem. Right. Sometimes complex problems require complex answers, and the one-size-fits-all isn't going
to
fit here.
Do you believe – okay, I would agree. Maybe not in every school. Again, it should be up to the school to decide whether or not you want one or not. But my question to you is, based on sort of the negative response to this call for guards from some leaders in the African-American community, are they thinking wisely?
Well, I think they would look at – sort of the demographics in a lot of predominantly African-American schools. There are already armed guards there, and they're already speaking to the behaviors that they see going on there. Right?
I think that,
and so you could argue that maybe the deterrence has already occurred because the guards aren't there. You don't hear of these mass shootings in
schools
of color.
No. One of the things that you notice about some of these
schools. Outside the schools, you do.
Exactly.
Some of these schools have been in pretty calm neighborhoods, not dangerous. So if you were thinking, where
suburban
in the country would I put them, you wouldn't have necessarily. But there's another issue that you really notice in the African-American comments about police with guns in schools. And that's this larger notion that we hear again and again about the notion that the police in African-American communities are seen as adversaries liberties, even by law-abiding citizens. Absolutely. I don't see how you can solve many of the problems that we have unless those relationships are repaired. The idea that if people give information and are called snitches, rather than seeing the police as essentially on their side, I just don't see how you can get past the problem.
But let me just say that this conversation over the last, 12 minutes or whatever we've been on this segment has shown more openness to divergent points of view than what we got out of President Obama in his press conference last Monday. And I believe that his inaugural address for the second term was the press conference on Monday. And that is my deep concern. My deep concern is that he is prepared to separate and to demonize and to attack anyone who doesn't agree with his pre-adopted, preconceived, left-wing solution. And that is
he proposed some additional security in schools, and it was African American leaders that poo-pooed his idea.
I would say that I hate it when people say, oh, you can't play politics with things. That's what politicians do.
They play politics. I agree.
And so the way that the man is always attacked,
you seize the opportunity,
one, either to advance your agenda or to protect yourself. Because if he doesn't do anything and he doesn't have an aggressive response to this slaughter of six-year-old children, then the next time it happens, and it's not if, it's when the next time it happens, why didn't the president do something else? And then you'll complain about that. So I get it. You don't like the guy.
I don't like his politics. I get that. I like the guy.
But here, in Albuquerque, New Mexico today, there were five people shot dead by a teenager in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Oh, my God.
Today. 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us. Again, right before we went to the break, there was reference to the shooting that I'm sure you have probably heard about in Albuquerque, New Mexico. A teenage boy with several weapons, including an assault rifle, shot and killed five people, three of them children. The children appeared to be of elementary or middle school age. The boy was charged with two counts of murder and three counts of child abuse, resulting in death. His name has not yet been identified, at least on this report. And again, the use of assault weapons is legal in New Mexico, although state lawmakers are considering bills that would tighten gun laws and require background checks.
By the way, let me
ask you this question, quick one. Chris Robing. Background checks, just background checks. Are you for background checks?
Yes.
Is everybody for background checks?
Yes.
Yes, and the issue really is the private sales. So you said, Philip, you own a gun. If I were to try to buy the gun from you, there would be no background check. But if I went into a store and tried to buy it, so
That is the so-called gun show
loophole.
Exception.
Well, that's a
now,
gun show
now,
loophole.
I just want to say –
But private sales, too.
Right, but those are private sales. You go to a gun show and you are buying privately. Okay, now, here again, let us recognize, passing a law about that, and I'm all for background checks. This does nothing about the 350 million guns in circulation in the United States that are mostly, I believe, held by criminals. I mean, most of the 350 million are held by criminals, and they're being used on the South Side or on the West Side.
Most of the 350 million guns are being held by criminals?
No, whoa. You're totally wrong.
First of all, it's not
350 million.
I've seen that number. I saw that
number
over the weekend.
It must have been on the internet. Because the number,
well,
and
if
because
you can't
because,
believe the internet,
no,
they can't
weeks,
lie on the internet.
This show is on the internet.
2 weeks ago, the number was 200 million, and then last week
going through the roof.
300 million. Well, it has gone up.
And Bruce, we
don't
know.
But certainly,
we don't know
the vast majority.
That?
The vast majority are hunters.
Here's my
and
point.
Ordinary
the vast majority are. Okay, I stand
They're
correct.
Not bad guys.
I'm happy to hear it. I'm happy to hear it.
The people who own guns
are law-abiding citizens.
That
I understand. The vast
and
majority
present
of
present company
people.
Accepted naturally.
Now, what about this idea? What about this idea that when a gun – now, first of all, I think some of this is a waste of time.
Yes.
Because – whether it's 200, 300, 350 million, if we never manufactured another gun ever, there are enough guns in the United States to create a climate of either fear or protection, depending on where you are, because there will always be someone who will be able to get a gun who shouldn't have a gun, and there will be someone that will always be willing to sell a gun to someone that shouldn't have a gun.
Exactly.
And so the
no law is going to change that. You can raise the penalty for people that do it, but it seems to me that if you're a legal and honest person, you're not likely to do anything that's going to be antisocial. But we're looking at a small percentage of the people who have access to these weapons, and they're the ones, and just as last week's show, we looked at two issues. The country is all excited now about what are we going to do with, how do we stop school shootings? That's a small slice of the problem. It's the one that gets all the media attention because of this horrible situation, this massacre that took place a little over a month ago, where literally many inner city students have been getting slaughtered every day, year in, year out.
Right.
There hasn't been the outrage there. So, and if you would ask most people, I'm going to pull back. I'm not going to make the same mistake you said. Not most people. Some people. Some people, you know what their preference would be? Let's not let mentally ill people have guns. And they would also say, let's not let gangbangers have guns, because they shouldn't have guns. And basically what they're saying is we don't want black people to have guns.
Yeah, I don't know about all that. And if they're gangbangers, if they've done a crime and been convicted of a felony, they aren't legally allowed to have guns anyway.
Legally.
And so
here's the challenge for me is that you can't implement some public policy solution that is going to eliminate the problem of 10,000 gun homicides a year or 20,000 gun suicides a year. That it's just not possible.
Right.
I think about changing a climate, though. And is one life saved enough that you spend billions of dollars to affect that change? I don't know. Maybe every life is valuable, so maybe. I don't know.
Sam in Austin, Texas, listening to us on KLBJ. Nice to hear from Texas again tonight. Go ahead, Sam.
Well, hello, gentlemen. What I wanted to contribute was last week my son was put in the hospital. He had to be admitted. He got dehydrated, and so he had to spend a couple nights there. And as I went down to meet my wife there, she went in the ambulance with him. I walked up to the front, and there was all sorts of people in the waiting room, just a lot of people. And I finally found out from her over the phone what room he was in. So I told the lady what room he was in, and she just pointed me in a direction. And I went on past the security guard that was there, and I went in there. And, you know, I had a bag of stuff that I was bringing, of blankets and stuff. And I just thought, you know, how vulnerable this situation is to some madman. And it made me realize the number of places, a supermarket, you know. I mean, there's so many people sitting in situations that are vulnerable. It's not just schools. And
this is a very important point.
The situation, you know, where do we not put armed people? Should we have armed people to combat any random circumstance that may arise due to the modern situation of the world?
Sam, you know what I'm saying? You know, You've touched on a very important issue, and I'm going to give everybody a chance to respond to it. But again, and I said this the second week. It wasn't the week after the Sandy Hook, but I think I said it the second week. And that is, you know what we should be celebrating every Sunday night? Is we should be celebrating if there isn't some major catastrophe or massacre that happens.
We live
in a country with way too many guns, in my view. We live in a country with way too much undetected mental health or mental treatment. And we live in an open society. We want to live in an open society. I was absolutely flabbergasted when Aurora happened, Aurora, Colorado happened. Not because it happened. I'm surprised that that doesn't happen more often. Or if it does, it's hushed up. We should be celebrating that we have so many people with so many guns and so many mental so much mental illness in this country. Granted, it's horrible, you know, when 23, you know, young children are slaughtered, but I'm surprised it doesn't happen more often in this country.
Let me tell you one analogy that comes to mind. I'm an expert on international politics, so I've spent a lot of time reading articles about and listening to people who deal with problems of terrorism. And in the aftermath of 9/11, the original 9/11, there were a lot of people who were asking what could be attacked. And the answer is, you know, everything. The number of soft targets, the number of people, if they had a bad attitude, who could step out onto State Street in the Loop and just open fire and kill hundreds of people or go to a, you know, anything. So I think that while it may make sense to protect some particularly vulnerable soft targets, what Sam was saying about being able to walk into a hospital is true everywhere, because everybody, after this show is over, if I go to a grocery store, you know, it'll have dozens of people. If I get on a bus, it'll have. So the number of soft targets simply can't be protected. You can't approach it from that end fundamentally. There may be some you want to do, but you have to approach it on the mental health side and on other kinds of approaches, I think.
Just by the way, I also think that we have to look at the drugs that some of these people were taking.
Yes.
When they acted out. I am not an expert in this area, but I have friends who are medical doctors, and there is a very disturbing pattern,
really,
especially with these teenage shooters, that they are on something,
cocktails of drugs,
Ritalin, or drugs that are given to kids,
or they miss their meds.
Either
they don't have drugs or they haven't taken enough of
them. The most serious day-by-day issue is the one you were talking about violence in poor areas that are drug-infested, where people are shooting each other all the time. And the number of six-year-old girls that die on their front porch in Chicago each year is just heartbreaking.
Right.
Let's go to Pete in Lowell, Indiana, listening to us on WLS. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Pete?
Go ahead, Pete.
Yeah, my comment about the gun thing is we've already got teachers and principals and assistant principals and guidance counselors in schools. If they have a permit to carry a gun and they're trained, then we should be letting them carry.
Right.
They're there to protect our kids and teach them. Teach them priority one, but protection. If some nut's in there with a gun, the responsibility of any adult is to get between the kids in a nut job.
I got to tell you, Philip.
I'm a gun owner. I'm one of those sort of Western States Democrats, if I was so inclined. I'm a Second Amendment guy. I didn't learn anything about guns until I went into the military. And the thing that I learned about them is they're a tool and they're ways that they're supposed to be handled. And I consider myself fairly progressive, one of those liberal types. So this is going to be probably a little disturbing for some people. I think we need more of an emphasis on gun safety, and that we need to de-glamorize firearms, and maybe we need to start teaching in schools gun safety, so that the mystique of it and the glamour of it is taken away.
Excellent idea. Back shortly. 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. A reminder for those listening within the sound of the WLS signal that next Friday, the 25th of January through February 28th, we will present a special exhibition at the museum, Harold Washington on the Air, a 30th anniversary retrospective, the radio and television careers of one of Chicago's most charismatic, political leaders who really was in the forefront of maybe launching the career, perhaps, I think most would agree, certainly contributing to the success of Barack Obama. It's the radio television career, and again, it will be for 1 month, and there will be no admission. We are open Tuesday through Saturday. We're at 360 North State Street, nonstop Harold Washington programming, and again, its admission is free from the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Let's go to Diane, listening to us patiently on WLS Radio in Chicago. Go ahead, Diane.
Oh, hello.
Hello.
I am a product of the Chicago Public Schools.
Me too.
And I went to Waller High School, which is now called Lincoln Park.
Yep.
Back in 1968, when I was a freshman, we had armed plainclothes and uniform policemen in the school. They are still, not the same ones are still there, but there are still armed guards in the school. The ones who are not directly employed by the Chicago police are usually former police department veterans. And I survived two riots at my school, one in 1968 and one in 1971. They were massive. Multiple squad cars, multiple paddy wagons, people packing heat all over the place.
Holy cow.
And I'll tell you something. When is the last time, I challenge any of you gentlemen, when is the last time we have had a mass shooting in a Chicago public school? I can't remember one because we have guys in the school to shut down bad activity. The problem we have here is that children are not safe when they leave the school.
Right.
They are not safe when
they leave the school, and they are subject to violence.
Yes.
Exactly. And this is part of the problem. You know, we have crossing guards who are employed as auxiliaries of the police department so kids can cross the street. But we really need to have not just parent patrols, but we need to have guys walking the beat, you know, who are out there when the kids are going to and from school.
I believe, Diane, whether it is, and again, I think, I don't think this should be a federal dictate. I think it should be something that local school districts and local principals can decide, you know, what form. Do they want someone in a uniform? Do they want someone plain clothes? I would argue that it's an opportunity for some people who are veterans, who are younger, who are returning from military service. It would be a job opportunity for them. But I also believe that there's an opportunity if this particular security guard is not some 80-year-old guy who can barely get the gun out of the holster, but again, a sort of a young, fit, vigorous, security guard. It seems to me that that person could have some mentoring or some positive impact on the people that are in that school. And in schools where maybe there's some resistance to, you know, a police presence, I mean, it's almost an officer-friendly concept with a gun, because he would be a first responder, and one would assume that he would be able to at least respond quickly, as it takes, you know, a varying degree of response time in the shootings that we are aware of. Listen, thank you for your call. Let's go to Matt in Fort Wayne, Indiana, listening to us on WoWo. You're on the air.
Hey, everyone. I just want to say hi.
Thank you.
I like the show. I listen to it every week, so
great.
I appreciate all the work you do.
This year, I'm going to promise the people at WoWo don't even know about what I'm about to say. But this year, I'm going to come and do the show from Fort Wayne, Indiana, some Sunday night.
All right. Oh, really? Okay.
Drive there in your Studebaker.
How you doing, sir? Just keep me informed on the date, and I'll be.
Well,
sure
good. We'll be talking about it. We're not just going to surprise you. But go ahead with your question.
No, well, I don't have a question, but more of a point. The point I believe, if my information is accurate, I believe in Aurora, Colorado, the shooter had a 100-round drum magazine, right?
I believe you're correct.
Yes, he did.
Okay, well, on that point, okay, now that I know that I'm correct, my dad, he was in the Air Force for over 20 years. You'll sir, sign that. Over 20 years, and he told me that any clip or magazine over 30 rounds is absolutely pretty much basically unreliable because it's
going to jam because it's so much pressure.
Too much weight on the
spot. At once, thank you, sir. Mm-hmm. And so much pressure at once that it's spitting out bullets so fast that the pressure is going to mount up and it's just going to jam. And I believe that's the case in this Aurora shooting. I believe it jammed on him, and that's why he only, if my memory is correct, he only got over 20 rounds off.
Does that have any implications for the laws and that sort of thing?
No, I guess not. I don't really have a question or anything. I just wanted, I've never heard anybody bring up the fact that any...
Philip Beverly was nodding as you were speaking, Matt. Go ahead, Philip.
And so when I learned to shoot M16s in the military, the firearms instructors always tried to dissuade you from using 30-round magazines. They said, oh, that's what they put in those Hollywood movies and dissuade you from firing on full auto because it's going to pull up into another direction. You're not going to hit your target. I'm not as concerned about magazine capacity. I think that as people adapt, if a dedicated shooter wants to shoot, he's going to go for soft targets. That's just the way it's going to be, and that the magazine capacity isn't important. There was a young man, 12 or 13 years old, who went into a school and had actually one-shot kills. And they asked him, kid, where'd you learn to shoot like that? He said, playing video games, honed his skills in how to do that.
Unfortunately, whatever comes out of Washington is not going to resolve the demented individual who wants to go and do harm.
That is so
true. He'll find the guns. He won't care whether they're legal or not. He will get into the schools if it's locked down. And yes, he would even take out an armed guard if the armed guard was there. So nothing that's coming out of Washington is going to totally resolve this. We just happened, again, in future shows, we'll talk about what we can do to sort of, deal with the sensitivity issues that need greater addressing by this country. Our thanks to Chris Roebling and Charles Lipson and Philip Beverly for joining us on this edition of Beyond the Beltway, a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio. Thanks to Dan Dorfman and Tom Veracruz for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.